Hello, Jimmy.
Hello, Angela.
This is Books Are
Books Good. Are Good.
Actually. And for the month of November, we are reading Reform or Revolution by Rosa Luxemburg. Hooray, I didn't fuck up a title and author for once. So
should we title this episode No Reform November?
No Reform November. I'll put it somewhere.
A subtitle.
Yeah. All right. Cool. Yeah. So let's get into it. General thoughts and feelings. I think you went last time, Jimmy. I never remember this shit.
No
so
worries.
I'll go. So this book. Well, so I got the Rosa's like writings and other things that happened. So I was like, okay, it's gonna be like 200 pages, and then it turns out, oh no, it's probably like maybe like 120. Unfortunately, I realized, oh no, I'm actually reading a react video of Bernstein's arguments, which we have not read before, and this was my first time ever encountering them. So it was very difficult to kind of get through the book. Once she was off of like Bernstein's argument or Makes his argument and then kind of goes on, it was fine, but it was very difficult to kind of retain some of the information that she was writing about. Some things was kind of old, not old hat, but just like, oh, okay, I've seen this idea before, so I kind of understood. Other times I was just like, what is Bernstein's argument again? Like, what is he trying to say? And I had to kind of take Rosa's words for it. So
yeah,
definitely felt like a react video of your bread tuber about some conservative or somebody else. And you're just like, I'm not going to watch that person. So,
yeah.
Like,
at least with the react video, they can like put clips in.
This is true.
And with a 120 page like rebuttal, you don't want to also source like another 100 pages of quotes, because then it's going to be a 220 page rebuttal.
Yeah. I also like the way, as I recall, how they did things was like these were like pamphlets or very short little like books, and they're supposed to be easily digestible so that people can read them and then be like, oh, okay, so Bernstein's like a fucking piece of shit, he doesn't know shit, and then
yes.
Bernstein write his reply and it'll be shorter and yada yada yada. So
I think this originally was like two-parter.
Yes. Yeah,
so it would have been like a 60 page pamphlet.
Yeah, so I think the general ideas, and as we go into the questions, are pretty solid. As you've probably known, I am very much let's try not to do a revolution, but this has made me question that position, which is what books I think are supposed to do for the most part. Anyway, Jimmy, why don't you go into what are your thoughts and feelings?
Sure. Thoughts, Rosa, gone too soon. I feel like she has, let me back up and say, very similar. Haven't read Bernstein. I have encountered other people trashing him because, what podcast was it? It's not Red Scare, but it's another like Stalinist Marxist podcast that was Marxist literature. And they read, I think it was State and Revolution by Lenin, if I'm remembering. And I listened to all of that. And a good chunk of State and Revolution by Lenin is just him trashing Bernstein. So like this was maybe not hearing Rose's perspective on this, but getting to listen to that, like this was familiar ground, in particular trashing him. What's interesting is there's another German socialist, Kautsky, that Lenin also trashes and spends most of his time trashing over Bernstein in State and Revolution, along with Lenin, and Rosa also trashes Bernstein. So there's like levels of trashing Bernstein, which is pretty great. Everybody knows this dude is fucking wrong. It's just then a question of to how far is he wrong?
Yeah. Yeah, because like people had, it seemed like, well, I have not read State or shit. Wow, you just said the title. I didn't read Lenin's books, but just the fact that I wonder if there's different avenues in which they trash Bernstein's ideas, but perhaps everything that's described within Reform and Revolution was kind of the totality of his ideas. And everyone's just like, no, they're all stupid. There's nothing worth like saying maybe you're right on some things, but it's like, no, you're just bad ideas, dude. Sorry.
As far as the writing itself, Rose is pretty good about keeping things moving. Like, I don't feel like anything really dragged. It certainly would have been good to have, like, a modern rewrite of this where, like, clips of Bernstein being dumb were made available. Like, it would be fun to have, like, a bread tube read along where they have, like, the guest voices do all of Bernstein's bits so that it's, like, differentiated in my mind. Because, like you were saying, sometimes it is hard to, like, keep straight what it is that is being refuted when it's all
right.
Just coming from a single voice. And then I didn't read it. I listened to an audiobook of it. So that was probably another part of it, in that I was washing dishes at the same time. So part of my brain was engaged with something else. But nonetheless, definitely more of a well-trod path. For me, I've definitely seen a lot of these arguments, both with respect to Bernstein and also in general with respect to versus revolution.
Yeah. Okay, so before we kind of get into some questions, we're going to summarize kind of Bernstein's arguments and Luxembourg's arguments. So first off, with Bernstein, he straight up kind of rejects a lot of things from Marxist's ideas. So he's operating on he's saying he's like a social democrat or like even socialism, but like his arguments are for like essentially, we need to make the poor to middle class, and then we'll also have these, they'll also be able to participate in the capitalist system. We should do these different reforms or legislative things so that we can make the capitalists do. Like, they should follow the laws. He also really is against kind of unions. He thinks that if there's unions, they will depress the wages for the boss. And then also kind of misunderstands unions, because, like, getting a union is really just...
Everything.
Yeah, but, like, unions in particular, because it's just, like, besides, like, oh, well, depresses the wages of the boss, it's just, like, no, unions are supposed to make workers get the piece of the pie. And then there's that. And then the fact that, there's these like his thoughts of like cooperatives are like really weird. He thinks that credits isn't. Oh, right. The big thing is that he does not believe that capitalism does these collapses that happen, or pretty much these really big downturns or these crises that happen. And then like. Rejiggers itself and then kind of goes back, doing its usual bullshit. He's like, no, that totally doesn't happen. It just adapts. That's what's going on. It's just adaptation. That's what's happening. And then there's something about credits that he like talked about, but he like really misunderstood how credit worked in terms of like, he thought pretty much Rosa refuted his credit thought with like, credit is just not real money. It is just borrowing against the people. It's not a thing that really exists. So yeah, he's just all over the place with just, like, he just doesn't understand like capitalism. And then he also doesn't understand Marxism, but he already just rejects it anyway. So it's like, the thing with Bernstein is that, unfortunately, he is not a good representative for reformism. He's a horrible representative for him because he obviously just doesn't understand any of the art, like any of the things he's trying to criticize, and which sucks. Like,
I would argue that he is a good example of the reformist because he does not understand capitalism or Marxism. And it's only through not having a thorough understanding of capitalism and Marxism that you can come to and achieve a socialist state through reform in capitalism.
Yeah, he is. I guess I can see that. My problem is I can't really say, oh yes, this is generalized like reformists, like how their outlook is, because there's only one example of someone I just read about recently, third hand. So
who is that?
Well, I mean, I'm just saying from Rosa's like point of view, you know, it's So I'm trying to, for reformists out there, I'm trying to like root for you a little bit. But like, this is a bad, bad first play right here. Bad first person you like brought out and read. So Bernstein, super wrong, yada, yada, yada. Luxembourg pretty much refutes everything about essentially capitalists won't play their, by the rules. Bringing people into the middle class doesn't really solve anything. It makes them just still be part of the capitalist system. The fact that Bernstein went on about fucking shareholders, or like, oh yeah, like he Bernstein's thing is really more about the individual doing, making things happen instead of bring like how instead of the system, like bring a different system to make things happen. And Rosa just refutes that and saying like, no, we're still, you're still operating the fact that capitalism and the state and these capitalists will want to play fair when they will try to essentially, they will adapt to do what, what some workers want, but then there's always a price for it. It's always a monkey's paw for this shit. So, you know, so this book was written 19, I'm just trying to think, was this post Russian Revolution or?
No. Yeah. 10 years pre for the complete volume. The parts came out even earlier.
Right. So in a sense, she was kind of, I mean, I guess there were other revolutions, but French, right? But that wasn't really a socialist revolution. So in a way, Rosa's kind of working from a theoretical standpoint, right? Like,
there was an attempt, but unfortunately it was stymied very quickly into the revolution. Well, it depends which revolution we're talking about, because like the original French Revolution pre-Marx, I feel like we can't really look at revolutions, Marxist writings in the sense of like, is this socialist? Because like, there were very few socialist writers at the time who didn't have idealist instead of a perspective. Because I mean, Hegel is like at the time of the French Revolution putting his writings down. So like, dialectics didn't exist at the time to properly critique capitalism. So the French Revolution in the 40s or 1850 had some socialists with like Bakunin and a couple other individuals participating directly who would go on to be like foundational minds in social anarchism.
So reason why I was asking was, or trying to get clarification, is just the fact that Rosa is still working on it, like, okay, so a revolution does happen, like, or reforms have been a thing, and they've there's been attempts. We got to do a revolution because at this point, we've already seen the outcome of our reforms. Nothing fucking changes. So,
or the revolutions that occur because they don't have the appropriate on capital and socialism fail because they engage with the existing capitalist class.
All right. My one other point about Bernstein was the fact that he also very much was like, ah, if we get spread democracy amongst everybody who's having a chance to vote, then things will also change that way, which we've found over and over and over again. No, it doesn't. Granted, his probably his his measurement of democracies was very not like, it's not good. Like, this was the late 1800s in Germany voting kind of was super new, so like it's you know, I can see from his point, hey, only rich, like pretty much middle class people are doing it, we should expand this out further, or middle class, actually not really. I don't know what Germany's voting stuff was, but I assume it was probably just as restrictive as the Americans. So probably wasn't that many people voting. So his probably thought was like, oh, if we get more people to vote, middle class, because I fucking love the middle class, then, you know, we'll be good. People vote in their best interests. And it's like, well, no, I'm sorry. That's just, there wasn't the political science of that to study that wasn't happening yet. And, you know, this is a nice thought, but no.
And it also, so it does a couple things. Is one, it creates a middle class or a professional middle class, or supposes one, when those individuals, through one lens or another, should be considered to be part of the working class, the capitalist class, and then the proletariat.
Right.
At the end of the day, like, yes, there are subdivisions. Yes, there's intersectionality. But when we're talking just at its bare bones, when we're looking at capitalism, the middle class is a myth. It's just a privileged that is right. Used by design to keep to create a barrier, which is also why, like, it's, well, one, it's fascinating to like note like just how long since the proper conception of capitalism through a Marxist sense that people have been obsessing about the middle class.
Yeah.
It never ends. But then two, it's, so something you mentioned earlier was this desire to see the poor brought up to become members of the middle class, which just belies a complete lack of understanding how capital works and what the purpose of the proletariat in capitalism is, because you cannot have a functioning like capitalist system. All members of the system are either capitalists or middle class.
Right.
Because the profit share in that case would be too small for the capitalists to ever consider that and engage with. Even the United States, in its heyday of neoliberalism, the mid to late 90s into the early aughts, the recession, still had an underclass, even though we had exported so much of our proletariat class to developing countries and had one of the largest middle classes in the world as far as sheer volume, accumulated wealth attributed to the middle class. Like even with all of the reforms that we have put together, it has not been attained a society of just middle class.
Yeah. There's that. Also, not kind of what's missing from this book and a lot of early, I think, you know, literature during this time is, yeah, the kind of hidden underclass of women, mm-hmm. in some cases, you know, Black folks in America, mm-hmm. Or Black probably other, yeah.
Chinese, Asian.
Yeah. So there's kind of, I would say that's like a very big blind spot. Mm-hmm. When it comes to this, like one of the blind spots with some of these readings, which I can kind of get why some people now say, like, it's fine to read theory and these authors, but like at the end of the day, like that was, some things are very modern and contemporary, and other things is just like, yeah, this didn't consider like other mm-hmm. people as people then, so. Like, maybe
or
don't take it super
necessarily
seriously.
Have the available context.
Yes.
I mean, they weren't living in the United States. The amount of information out of the United States regarding these and the plight of their community is small. So, like Lenin does make mentions, and does Marx make mentions of Black underclass being essentially the basement and foundation of American capitalism. They just didn't have the context to understand the extent of just how awful things were.
Yeah, like you would have to be in certain circles to figure that out. Like if you had somebody, like if your cousin was part of the abolition, they were over in America and they were sending you letters back. Like it was, yeah, as you said, like it's very, the information out from America, and you had to run in certain social circles or, you know, different groups to kind of know what was going on, and my ignorance of Germany, you know, there might have had like a underclass in Germany or what was going to be soon Germany, since Germany wasn't a thing. Whatever. Anyway, yeah. So.
So that pretty much, I feel like, sums up Bernstein's argument, and we can probably really quick sum up Luxembourg's arguments against it, which are: you're wrong, you don't understand Marxism, your statements contradict each other, and you're wrong.
Yep. What is very interesting, though, is that Rosa doesn't say how to do a revolution.
Yeah, sure.
So, which, like, it's just interesting, you know, for both of us, granted, it's not how to do a revolution part 500 or whatever, but it is interesting that she pretty much is just arguing against, like, reformism, but she doesn't say, yeah, so we do a revolution, but, like, how does that look, right?
Sure.
And that is, I think, where Blanquism. Yeah, that gets brought up a lot, or a couple times. And that was always, I guess, the next argument point that a lot of folks had, when it's like, okay, so we're doing a revolution, but how do we do it? And
yeah.
I think that will always forever be the question of how do we do a revolution.com.
Yeah. So the thing that pretty much every revolutionary socialist writer will say is it's dependent on the material in a particular place and time. And then there's also is it sufficient to do a revolution in a particular country or a particular, like, region, or does it, you have a Trotsky, it has to be in and across the world. Blanquist idea is essentially like vanguardism, which we, right. even though, like, Rosa is putting that down in this particular reading, like, the closest, the other, so, like, both Cuba and China, I would say, don't fit that mold because they both required a retracted people's war.
Yeah.
Cuba's was short. China's much longer. But they both required, like, multiple months, if not years, of war to win their socialist revolution. Whereas, like, the closest you can probably come to being, like, a vanguard party, like a Blanquist revolution was successful, was the USSR, in that, like, the way a Blanquist revolution described it, it's very reminiscent of French revolutions, mm-hmm. where it's like, it's over and done with, in at least is like the second French Revolution was over and done with in 6 days to okay. topple the existing government before, like, the, like, new, like, revolution, which then was very quickly co-opted by the capitalists, then Napoleon, what's his name, like the second or the third in 1848. That's the revolution that Marx wrote the Infirmaire about. But I would argue, like, the one case where a protracted people's war was not required for a revolution was the Russian Revolution, and that's, for the most part, like, guided by a vanguard party. There's some evidence that it can work, but once again, it's materially dependent. Like, I don't think a vanguard party could guide a revolution in the United States.
So I just have a question, because I think, so the way that vanguard parties are described, I keep thinking it's a standing army. So is that a separate thing? Is that, like, to me, like, if we're supposed to have, well, some people are like, oh, we need to have a standing vanguard party. I'm like, okay, so that's just an army. What is the difference between an army and a vanguard?
So the vanguard party, like, a great example is the Bolshevik, where there's maybe only like 50 or 100 of them, at least as far as like the main organizational body prior to the revolution. And their purpose is to capitalize on, like, nascent revolutionary tendencies. So if there's a strike, they show up and they try to guide the strike. If there's, like, a tenants uprising, they show up. They provide organizational support. They try to guide the tenant uprising in a direction. Yeah. So, like, it's essentially creating, like, a consultant class
Okay.
of revolutionaries.
So I guess, like, kind of Yeah. Maybe the Black Panther Party could be considered a vanguard party of like this.
Absolutely.
Rights. Right.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So, and then Blinquist seemed to one to have kind of like, there needs to be like Spec Ops vanguard party or like,
yes,
in a way.
And yes. And the Blinquist like idea of like, it is essentially like an explosive, like revolutionary moment that topples the state, like almost immediately. So like it really was only a possibility in like 1700s and 1800s.
Yeah, like it, or also a possibility when the state is very just like is so fucked that anything could kind of topple it over.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a very, very specific, man, that's like, just, it's not even like an ace in the hole. It's just kind of like, okay, well, I hope all the conditions and other things work out to where this has worked, or otherwise we're all going to be, like, killed. Like, you know.
Yes. That's... And, like, that sort of, like, revolution is still possible in places, but it's... They're very small and not very developed.
Yeah.
And also need to be places where, like, the United States or China or Russia hasn't been funneling, like, large amounts
yeah.
of arms and, like, military equipment.
Yeah. Like, yeah. like this Blinquism would work when the world was not nearly as connected. Yeah. It still wouldn't even work, like, yeah, pretty much, as you said, very late. Or like pretty much in the 1700s, after Industrial Revolution kind of started happening, that was mm-hmm. kind of game over.
Yeah, like the last like good example of it would be like the revolutions of 1848, and so much of those revolutions was not necessarily due to a vanguard party, and like outside of like a vanguard revolution on purpose. All of those revolutions were. Primarily due to people starving in droves because of the terrible like crop yields from like 1804 to 8, like they had, like all of Europe was fucked for 4 years, and that led to the French Revolution, a German Revolution, an Italian Revolution. I don't remember. It was in a good source for this, and it's a very short. Season, but the I think 7 of the Revolutions podcast just goes over the Revolution 48 separately from the French Revolution, which gets its own section.
Gotcha.
Just because of how critical those were laying the groundwork coming German Russian Revolution. German unsuccessful in the long term, Russian more successful in the long term.
Gotcha. Okay. So had a nice diatribe about vanguard parties and other fun stuff, but it kind of relates to the overall.
Find
talking.
And join your local vanguard party near.
don't, because they're probably filled with feds. Anyway, moving on to questions.
Form your own vanguard party.
Yeah, thank
and
you. Yeah.
For everyone that you include, immediately ask them, "Hey, are you a fed?" And when they say no, take them at their word.
Super, this is the Vanguard Party tip corner on This Is Books Are Good Actually podcast. All right. I guess we'll go into some questions that we got from the wonderful socialistrevolution.org. They had a nice reading guide that we totally read before we started this podcast. We got
we'll
questions from them.
It.
Yeah, we'll link to it. So, first one up is, in what ways is credit a mighty instrument for the formation of a crisis? Are there any examples you can think of? Jimmy, do you want to go first?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And this is something that is immediately on, I'm sure, both of our minds. But the period of zero interest rates that the United States was doing for a number of years up into early, like late quarter one, early quarter two. At which point they ratcheted up interest rates, and that has resulted in a lot of companies who were essentially living off of free money in the form of zero or near 0% loans, realizing, hey, we don't actually make profit, so we can't pay back loans require interest. So we're just going to lay off thousands of people because we never had a coherent strategy to begin with for how to.
Yeah, that is most startups, most mm-hmm. tech startups. That's why they are, besides, you know, not having a fucking product, you know, they just get these monies from VCs or whatever, or from bank loan. And then they're like, oh shit, we didn't figure out how we're going to do it. And then they belly up and VCs are out of money. Banks are like, okay, I guess. But yep. Yeah. I would also say maybe this is, I'm not going to say it because I realize that I don't have enough information. I'll be fumbling through it. So
It's okay. Our listeners have no way of correcting.
Yeah, there's nothing to connect them together to get information at all. I guess I'll say like the 2008 financial crisis and like the subprime mortgage stuff.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, kind of essentially everyone's like, yeah, subprime mortgages. And then everyone's like, oh, yeah, pay up, buddy. And no one can pay. So then everybody gets to foreclose on their house. And also, there was like not many jobs. A lot of folks who were leaving college in 2008 were like, time to go back into it to get my grad, get more in debt and go to grad school. Hopefully things will turn out better. And it depends, really. So that was, and then, you know, too big to fail bank bullshit. That was, they managed to kind of come out of that unscathed. You know, they get to have like their little slap on the wrist of like, okay, pay us $1 million for your fine. And then we're done. Everything's good now. None of this will happen ever again because we told you not to do it.
I mean, if we had the sufficient regulatory bodies, it probably wouldn't happen again because so much of what happened was not due to necessarily a ton of people being unable to pay subprime back because of the rationing interest rate. Right. It was because those products were then repackaged from the B-rated capital products or credit products to being AAA-rated products. Mm. So people were then selling and betting on products that they were AAA-rated, but not. So if the in the case of that, if we had the appropriate regulatory bodies to ensure that people weren't directly lying and committing fraud, at least that crash could have or could be avoided in the future. Now, is it in the interest of the capitalist class to allow formed? No. And such, the IRS, the SEC, you to be underfunded, unable to investigate to prevent fraud.
Yeah. Like the reason why you're hearing a bunch of like low hanging fruit stuff about like, oh, someone got caught on tax fraud, like, and it's someone who probably makes like not a whole lot of fucking money, like they fucked up and did a side gig and they didn't report it or whatever, or did some other weird shit. And it's just like,
it's like only you're supposed to pay your like contractor taxes quarterly.
Yeah. It's like, that's the only amount of money, like, that's the only resources it can, like, get to. It's like, okay, I guess we'll just get the, and then, like, in the grand scheme of things, it's like, hey, can you please, let's just do a payment plan, and we'll just walk away from this, because that's, like, really all we can really do, and, you know, like, why isn't the IRS doing our fucking taxes? That's another fucking thing.
Into it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, yeah, so, credit, at least as far as like local credit, like on paper, it's fine. But the way that our for providing credit individuals have been formed, it is only ever a means exploiting the underclass for in one form.
Yeah. And the way that they obfuscate, you know, the terms, how they plan to like you to pay you, like how to pay back, you know, the credit and things like that, they purposely make it difficult to do the right thing at, like for a lot of stuff.
So if the state represents the capitalist class, why would it ever introduce labor legislation?
I think why, to keep the masses happy, to make them not want to fucking rise up and do anything. That's a way to do that instead of doing a war, especially when war is like really unpopular. Say you're doing pretty like, much. Okay, yeah. you know, like, hey, we'll do finally, oh, we'll give a week for parental leave, or we even just make parental leave a thing. Okay, all right, like, cool. That gives us another year where people are like, wait a minute, I'm still getting fucked. So, mm-hmm.
And that also gives you something to claw back slowly. Yes. Very similar to like the Fed having its interest rate at 0% essentially for so long meant that it had nowhere to go to tighten the reins or to loosen the reins further, by creating a social labor legislation, you have something to chip away at, like get panic, rather than like creating the conditions for revolution by already having things that when you go into a crisis, you are essentially having hungry workers showing up at your factory every day with pitch. Yeah. Be like, well, things are tough right now for everybody, so we can't do food deliveries every week. We're going to have to move it back to every other week, but we're still going to try and get you food. We're still going to try and provide somehow. And so that sort of like loosening and ratcheting back makes it so that the progress, at least as far as like the living conditions, are never solidified. It's always one step forward, two steps.
Yeah. It's kind of you're kind of like in an abusive relationship where mm-hmm. you get like a bunch of abuse and then it's love bombing and then mm-hmm. back to much of abuse again and then love bombing. Mm-hmm. And then you're just in a state of just like, okay, well, if I just do things a certain way, then they will back off. Or I don't know, you know, as long as I don't piss them off, it'll be fine. You know, mm-hmm. so there's just that push and pull that people like our society just like gets into and probably for some don't realize.
Yeah, that's a really great way to put it. Especially since like all abusive work of the relationship always put on the
yeah
for the abused party. Like, yeah. So as soon as democracy shows the test to negate its class character, is in the real interest. The democratic forms of sacrifice and by its state representative. This feels like a another way of phrasing what we just said.
Yeah.
So modern examples of this would be like the promising of college education to military recruits and then expansion of college education through state funding of state colleges and then as the expectation of a college and requirement of education in the workforce, increase of the cost of a college education, and the ratcheting back of state funding where you are required to have a college education. Only options for getting it are either enlisting in perpetual war machine or engaging extreme avalanches of debt when tie you subsistence, which being a part of the financial required you to go into such debt.
Right. I guess in a way, I'm thinking of bills are attempted to pass but got chipped away is, you know, healthcare. Anytime we try to do anything with healthcare, it immediately starts getting stripped back. Mm-hmm. You know, actually any lot of, you know, reforms that try to get any traction in the United States definitely either gets accepted, but by the time it's done through the process, it doesn't look anything like it was before. You know, just other items like that.
Mm-hmm. Or even the recent movement to like defund the police.
Right.
In pretty much any city where any sort of defund the police, it either voted down in the few cases where it passed. It was then vetoed or immediately afterward was reshaped, renegotiated, re-legislated upon. Result, no one defunding And right. Most locations increasing
funding. Yeah. And when they like increase funding too, it wasn't like, oh yeah, we're gonna okay. So like defunding is just not a politically whatever, you know, if we're gonna go with that excuse of like it's not politically advantageous viable. To do, yeah, viable. But we'll give more money to do what with? And it's like, oh, they probably just gave him a blank check and said, I guess they're just going to go buy more surveillance equipment. You know, like mm-hmm. there's no oversight into what the money does. And it's frustrating because like I talked with some other Black folks and they said, you know, defund the police isn't really. Sorry, this is going to be a fucking side tangent because it just bothers me. For some, defund the police just doesn't. It's just such a non-starter. You know, because it's like, well, crime in my neighborhood or crime in like places I used to grow up, it's still really bad. Like, we do need police. And it's really difficult to have a slogan like defund the police when you really are trying to say we need to actually make sure our money goes to more, effective means instead of just mm-hmm. funding more police. You know, so it's really slogans, man. We kind of stuck at it.
Yeah. Attacking the root problem of crime, attacking poverty and attacking lack of opportunity and attacking lack of necessaries, the base of Maslow's hierarchy, like
yeah,
almost all crime opportunistic and all crime that those opportunistic desires stem from I need to eat, I need to have clothing, shelter, a means to like move about the world. And if you address those, most crime would be.
Yeah. So
most crimes committed by the public, crimes committed by corporations would absolutely, but those yeah. are not policed anyway.
Yeah. So it's just one of those, but yeah, that's a good example of defund the police just pretty much got stopped dead in its tracks. Once it went up against any, came up in any like city, some people said, oh, defund the police. Like when during the election year, was like, oh, that was the reason that a lot of people didn't get like voted in. I kind of am skeptical of that just because polling yeah. has been so not indicative of anything, unfortunately. Like mm-hmm. this past election, everybody was like, oh yeah, it's gonna be like Democrats are gonna get fucking smashed and cut the red wave and blah 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 blah. And mm-hmm. then it didn't happen because but yeah, so
much of it is, especially with defund the police, is how the like polling on how the questions are formed.
Yes.
And if they're just left vague, like, what is your feeling on defund the police? You're going to get 1,000 different understandings.
Yeah. It's kind of like the question is like, oh, what do you think about the Healthcare Reform Act and Obamacare? And mm-hmm. That's why. I mean, polling is okay, but I think Nate Silver really fucked up his entire life because of polling mm-hmm. and prediction. Mm-hmm. Don't put all your shit in political polling baskets because everyone wants to be like, oh, people are very rational and they'll tell you the fucking truth. And the reality is like, not really at all.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm. yeah.
All right. Moving on to the next question, unless you have anything to add as examples. No. All right. No, what role does the state play in class societies? Why is it needed? This will be an interesting discussion because it's technically a philosophical question and actually a question that's been the big to-do in leftist circles. Mm-hmm. To have a state or not to have a state. Mm-hmm. I guess currently the state plays in current class societies is it's an enforcer of our classes. That's the thing. Mm-hmm. It's needed to actually control people and to also, you know, set everything up to go according to plan, which is these boom bust cycles. That's what it's really needed for. You know, I know this is not what the question's asking, but like, is a state needed after the revolution, after, you know, socialism comes through? And I don't really know. Part of me
would argue yes.
Yeah.
Just because like a classless, stateless society where everyone's needs are met sounds awesome. It also sounds exhausting because in a classless, stateless society, classless, great. Stateless, how much like negotiating you want to do on a date with everyone you encounter regarding the rules of how everything is going to function at every given moment.
Yeah.
Like, if we're just talking horse and buggy, yeah, we can probably not have a state in our local area and everything would be fine, because at the end of the day, the state would just be the populace coming to an agreement regarding how they want to live in a particular area. As soon as you have Ford F-150s doing 75 on your neighborhood road, you need to have a state.
Yeah.
Because the levels of complexity in the modern society are such that, like, even in a socialist society, you still need to have, in a stateless society, like, who's going to stop Purdue from dumping millions and billions of, like, gallons of, like, waste product into waterway? Like, who's going to stop Nestle from showing up at every waterway that hasn't been dumped in and siphoning away all the water? Like,
yeah, like, sorry, go on.
Like, even if these companies are, like, democratically controlled by their workers, and they may come to, in the case of, like, Nestle's water, like, a democratically probably would not try and buy up all the water of the world, because the workers would come to think that that's morally repugnant and, like, absolutely evil. However, it is entirely possible that you could have, if you, like, snap your fingers and Nestle's a democratically controlled organization owned by its workers, with the right set of workers, they will absolutely continue.
Yes, correct.
And so you still need regulatory bodies, and those regulatory bodies should not be hodgepodge creations at every, like, local level, because they're not going to have the means to do enforcement across regions, across states, across country, internationally, in a way that is appropriate and enforceable for the crimes that a worker-owned organization could still engage.
Yeah, and like, yeah, as you said, it's just so exotic. Like, just think about, okay, so you have, like, your, you know, your day job, and then, oh, by the way, you need to go and help manage, like, your state's, or your entire, like, or the entire United States, like, dealing with, not, for instance, getting enough chocolate or some shit like that, because somebody, they decided to, like, cut you off or whatever. And it's like, cool. So you're just going to keep working until, like, you're just grinded up, just trying to deal with a bunch of, like, different shit.
And also, like, in a stateless society, you would be required to be an expert in them.
Yes.
Like, have to know enough about WAN networking to be able to negotiate with a nearby township to allow your town to connect to their network. And to pass traffic between the two of you, you would have to be able to, like, speak to, like, doing, like, sharing of waterworks and of electrical grid. All of these things are so necessary and at the same time so eat up that we can't allow everyone negotiating these things on their own.
Yeah, I think that's just, like, that's the unfortunate part. Like, oh, we can, you know, everyone will just get their needs met and then everyone can, like, really contribute or whatever. And, like, I think, you know, it shouldn't be like that. Like, if you want to get organized or if you want to participate, that's great. But most people just don't. They just kind of want to be left alone and do their stuff and be able to have food, water, shelter, and internet or whatever, you know, creature comforts that they want. So, you know, yeah, just, stateless would be, like, fine, and guess, like, in certain communities, but it's just, like, such a, it still would be kind of a state in a way, even if it's, like, a community. It's interesting. I just don't think that's just possible.
I think a better way to think of stateless, like, a fluctuating series of temporarily negotiated states, at least as far as, like, decision-making bodies go. But even then, like, that runs into, like, I'd say the closest that like a stateless society could come to functioning, a great example what I think a stateless society could be that comes that function is what we read really early on in Ursula K. Le Guin's I'm blanking on the name. Do you remember?
The Dispossessed.
The Dispossessed. Where like you didn't have to work, but if you for the members of society that issued engaging any of the work projects that were made available to them to choose from, like they lost a lot of social standing because they essentially grifters to everyone else, even though they were still providing what they could through their own means, like putting on plays, like participating in the arts, like and that sort of thing. Like I feel like even if like someone's like in a society where you're not required to work, like they will still work, they will still perform labor.
Yes.
It's just a question of what labor are they performing. Like
yeah. And also I guess how we view that labor, right? Like our perception of it.
And like some people like think they want to just stay home and like lay on the couch. But if their needs were met and they were allowed to de-stress from trying to meet their needs and frequently failing to meet all the time, they would, one, have time to get back into a healthy headspace and likely a healthier physical state. And then, two, they'd get bored.
Yeah.
And they would probably do labor in some form or another for the community.
Yeah, like if you kind of look at a lot of like retirees that have been like who are for the most part taken care of or whatever, they still do stuff. And it may not always like some will still go to work, do part-time work, or some will try to be active in some other way. It may not be like doing work, but it might be doing like it might still be like it'll be doing some type of labor, and maybe they're not getting paid for it, but they'll like volunteer, you know, things like that. So yeah, I just think that some people, like as kind of mentioned like a past couple podcasts and just like other things, like we kind of have to just rethink how we think of labor and work. And that's going to be a very rough transition for folks. And like, yeah, some people might be like, oh yeah, I'm totally just going to do nothing. I'm just going to sit on the couch and just do fucking, just like, like catch up on all my TV shows I want to watch. And then after a point, they're like, dude, I want to go and like, you know, I'll go do something, you know, even if it's like, oh, I would just totally hang out with my friends all the time. After a point, my guy, like, you want to go do something else.
Yeah.
So
even if it's just like, go for a walk and put the trash in your neighborhood.
Yeah.
Like, or like, go down to a stream and like, remove debris, plant some plants, like, or yeah, like.
All right. Is there anything else you want to say about role? Does the state play in class societies?
Yeah, we definitely got on the tanner.
Yeah, we definitely did. My bad. I'm tangent central right now.
I feel like we pretty much touched on what we need as far as like in concept, like an anarchist society where there is no state and all of your theoretical sounds nice up and but it's unrealistic for the scope of society at large or ensuring safety. So, and not safety from like crime, what have you, street crime, altercations. Because once again, even if there is a police force, are not solved, let alone a majority of assaults are not solved, investigated. Majority of rapes, actually, almost all rapes are not investigated. So like the thing that the state needs to do to ensure your safety is regulate organization, in particular corporations, and provide for subsistence needs.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to skip the next question because we kind of talked about it's that.
Basically the same. Yeah.
Yeah. Is there such a thing as a premature revolution? Should Marxists worry about this eventuality? Premature. Yeah. I mean, could we say that some of the USSR's like revolution before? Well,
each
revolution was quote unquote premature until they got to the one that was the thing.
Exactly.
But,
and yeah, you can't just jump from like no revolutionary activity to full-blown revolution that everyone's behind on.
Yeah.
It is necessary to have the failures garner, like, the sympathy of society and the appreciation of society before your success will be accepted. Like, if the United States, like, in, like, the 30s went from Jim Crow straight to we're immediately signing, like, the Civil Rights Act and the additional following laws, and we have, like, Brown v. Board at the same time in 1937, the existing anti-racist movement was so small in, like, American society at large that it would have led to a revisionist backlash. Like,
right.
So huge that it would have not allowed for the passage to begin with. Like, so, like, it's only through the struggle and failure. It's dialectics. It's only through the struggle and failure that you get to the appropriate material conditions for the success.
Yeah, and I know that sounds kind of doomer, but, like, yeah. Like, unfortunately, you just have to be patient. The things have to line up. And you also have to recognize when actions start lining up that, okay, this is it. And unfortunately, that's, like, there's, like, so many false starts or, yeah, just things just fail and well, people not learning.
A lot
from
of times
things.
It seems like this is it and you have to go for it. But you have to also understand that it's probably not going to be it until it is it, and you'll never be able to tell until after the fact.
Yeah, for sure. Which, like, kind of sucks because, yeah, you have to know, like, you have to pretty much take the step to know that, okay, I'm on the right path. And then you figure out later, oh, fuck, I did the wrong thing. And then try to problem solve your way out of it. And it is a very painful, long process.
Yeah, but necessary. So,
yeah.
With that in mind, there are no premature revolution.
Yeah. They're only premature after the fact.
Yes. Yes.
I think from a self-help type thing, like, oh, you shouldn't think of, like, failure or failing or whatever, but I think that is something that should be on the mind if that type of thing, like, okay, so what happens if, like, the outcome of this is unfavorable or it's a very pithric, you know, victory type thing, what are their next steps afterwards? And I guess that's always, you know, you have to wait till it happens, but
yeah, because I mean, to quote the old lady, the best laid plans of mice and men.
Yeah,
even if you have a plan for what to do in the aftermath of a failed revolution, there are so many ways for both the state and society to react that you can't, unless your plan is leave the country and go to a country that has no extradition treaty.
Yeah.
If you stay in the country, you can make plans, but you can only plan so far.
Yeah. I guess an example of this would probably be kind of Occupy Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that happened at a really good time, or Iraq War, you know, 2008 financial shit. Everything seemed like, okay, it's going our way. We had Obama got elected. So, like, things looked pretty good. Granted, this is, it's not like a revolution, but it's definitely a, like, okay, we got our guy in, we can really punish the banks. And then, oh no, this is actually, a lot of people just gripped it off of fucking Tim fucking Pool. Like, that was his opportunity to get his stupid shit that's now around. But, like, yeah, that it, the failure was just, you know, you took
Breitbart
bullshit
as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think also Veritas, Project Veritas, I felt like kinda got their start there. A bunch of shitheads, really.
Both good and bad.
Yeah. Yeah. That really keyed off of a bunch of horrible bullshit. So it's not like, oh, Occupy Wall Street was, like, a bad thing, but it was just kind of one of those things where you can kind of look at that and say, oh, that was, like, that could have been it, but it wasn't.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. That's a great example. And yet we still need those things because
yes.
they they provide the space for experimentation, and then when they fail, as most will do until they don't, you have a learning opportunity for those that survive. You have critique for.
Yeah. Another example I just thought of was, you know, Black Lives Matter and the summer uprisings in 2020. Like, as we mentioned before, a lot of the defund the police that really backfired. However, in the past election, a lot of the, you know, Michigan area, like, they've eventually took like all three branches of their government, and they're passing reforms a lot on, you know, making abortion
Wisconsin
part of their.
As well?
Yeah. So, like, you know, a lot of these things didn't have the immediate outcome of what people wanted, but it did get people to, I think, start being like, okay, there's obviously an energy here for, like, people are fed up and they're mad and they want to see reforms on a lot of these things. Like, okay, I'm going to, you know, continue running for office or joining organizations to push these agendas that we want. And it took to, you know, 2 to 3 years to get them to happen, but they are happening. It's fucking slow as shit, but it is getting there.
And that circles back to the point of, we can't necessarily have like an explosive revolution that like just sweeps the nation and overturns everything once.
Right.
The only way to set the grounds for the revolution are to have a series of failed revolutions which create the social conditions for the reforms that allow for more radical failed revolution conditions for social reform, until eventually we're in a place where failed revolution does not.
Yeah. So I think, you know, I guess to kind of like wrap up this point, I think it's kind of like you kind of lose the battle, but you're winning the war. It's kind of like, I think revolutions are kind of like that. They're battles because you're trying to essentially change the mind of the masses or people who aren't really on your side, and it probably will fail. But the thing is that eventually you do win the war, but it's just this very long protracted war, which sucks. Like, will we ever know rest? No. That is
even after the revolution, there will not be rest.
There will not be rest. I think, unfortunately, I think some people kind of have the idea like, yeah, we'll have a big bang. Things will smooth out. I can go back and, you know, do whatever the fuck I want. No, that is not how these things work.
Another way to phrase it is for anyone who is comfortable with calculus, you can have a series that is approaching zero, but at no point is it, or you can have a series that is approaching infinity, but at every point is up until it reaches infinity forever away, still a calculable finite value. But we know that these things, even as they get smaller and smaller, infinitely smaller and smaller, they are not yet zero, but they will be zero.
Yeah.
Or infinitely larger and larger, still finitely as they approach infinity. They never get to infinity if you're measuring any particular step, but they do equal when calculated.
Yeah. All right. I'm gonna let you read this next question.
Sure. This is a edit. So is Marxism based? What are the practical implications of
the practical implications is you get a really cool Chinese anime about Marx, and it's very anime.
Yes. I didn't care for it because it's 3D animated.
Ah.
Yeah. And that's just, like, I can deal with some 3D animation sprinkled throughout, but I'm a 2D purist at heart.
It's gotten a lot better, but like when it's, I will say this, 3D for like mechanical shit is fine. Like, I can understand, like, I don't want to make a fucking 2D car because that's just annoying as shit, but
but so the original question is Marxism biased? What are the practical implications?
I'm trying to think of like, what do they, I know what biased means, but I'm trying to think of what is it biased?
I would say that Marxism is, the one thing it is unable to do, the structures that exist past socialism and communism.
Okay.
And Marxism is only capable of critiquing the current conditions and create some abstraction regarding the current systems going into the future. Like, there will continue to be further and further exacerbated crises that will extend and aggrandize the contradictions of capitalism. But Marxism is not able to, like, structure or explain socialist functioning.
Okay, gotcha.
So, which is then, like, where, like, once we have the USSR and Communist China, like, there's so much critique of them because they're trying to create socialist structures, and everyone agrees that the science of Marxism is right, but we don't yet have a science of socialism.
Gotcha. Okay, so I kind of understand this now, and I kind of looked back at the guide. So it's easy to critique things you can see. It's very difficult to, I guess, tell the fucking future or tell how things should work without actually having be able to study them.
Yeah, creating the new requires breaking of eggs.
Yeah.
Some people like their eggs and don't want you to break them.
Yeah, so I think the... where the practical implications of this is, like, kind of explaining this with the words socialism and communism is this for some people just a fucking no-go. So you kind of need to peel back certain aspects of it, aspects of society to kind of explain something that is, you know, with a socialist or communist tendency. And most people kind of agree in a way, like, if, you know, kind of like some people, like a lot of right-wing people say, oh, the corporations and stuff. And then, of course, they say they're racist ass shit. But, like, most part, they get to the right, like, for the most
economic
part, they're like,
conclusions.
Yeah. Yeah. And then they just go into some really weird fucking conclusion. So,
yeah.
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 All right.
So, anyways, Marxism is based.
That's all you got to get from that. And then for a final question, what can we learn or apply from Luxembourg's argument?
Don't bother reading Bernstein.
Yeah, probably don't bother reading Bernstein. Also, if you're a reformist or, like, you think, okay, reform's the best way to go, really fucking understand what the fuck you're talking about. And that still goes for me. Like, even though I'm like, oh, yeah, that sounds, revolution sounds kind of okay, but... violence bad though, except for self-defense, yada yada yada. But like, you if you want to do reform, you really gotta know your fucking history. You also really gotta know how the United States, like, in your government works. I think that's, like, part of the problem, and some of my frustration sometimes with other leftists is that I get annoyed when people are like, Biden should do thing, and I'm like, Biden, like, he can't just unilaterally do anything. So, like, like,
I
yeah,
mean, he can with executive actions, but their scope, like, he can't do everything.
Yeah. So, like, you know, I think the whole point is, like, I'm trying to just say that you got to really understand, okay, so how does a bill get through Congress? And how did, like, what the fuck does, like, that mean when it gets to the Senate and House? And, like, a bunch of shit like that. And
yeah. And not even, like, the, like, I'm just a bill version. But,
yeah.
Like, the current functioning, like, the made-up rules that shouldn't exist but exist, and all of our legislature abides by, that truly shapes how, like, these things happen.
Yeah. So, you know, I think so. There's, like, that. I think there is definitely you know, when I talked about earlier the just how Michigan was going with, like, their, you know, the current state structure, and just, you know, they got their gains there. I do see a lot of I do see good in reforming, like, doing reformist, like, stuff. Mm-hmm. But the way that Bernstein fucking describes it is fucking awful. So I kind of willing to maybe start reading try to look up other folks to maybe read about doing reformist stuff who is not Bernstein.
So I would say on that, like, the point to take away is not that only revolution is the way forward, only reform is the way forward. Reform can mollify the public, but reform can right. also create the grounds for revolution. Like, we could not have had as quick of a turnaround gay rights, the thousands, if we didn't first have Black Power movement, Black liberation, and the women's movement. Like, these reforms created the grounds for more radical that came after. And so you can't, as sick as just a constant revolution would be, at the same time, like, you need to have stable ground on which to build a new thing. You cannot build on quick.
Yeah, you pretty much need to be strategic, or try to be strategic with, you know, these situations. And a lot of times it's difficult to do, like, it's difficult to figure that out. Like, sometimes, unfortunately, you have to kind of play the dumb fucking game or the hand that you're dealt. And mm-hmm. as much as it'd be like, cool, I'm just not going to play that game, that's just, then you get fucking nothing. Mm-hmm. And it blows. Yeah.
Yep. Now, at the same time, like, there's definitely space for, like, explosive action. Like,
yes.
All of the oil protests where they're blowing paint on cars, they're paint on, like, paintings, even though the paint, or, like, sitting in traffic and forcing the state to remove you. Like, these things create the ground for the reform changes, which then in turn will create grounds for radical changes. So it is a cycle. The reform and revolution, like, as we know historically, like, we cannot have, like, a world revolution at this all at once. Things move too quickly. Governments have too much power.
Yeah.
But we, with a cycle of reform and revolution, and a reform and revolution, can get to a revolution for a socialist state is possible.
Yeah. It just takes time, but we can always make small wins that makes mm-hmm. a lot of people's lives easier. The question is, can we do it before the planet does a heat death? I don't know. That's where the doomer part comes in, right? Because it's just like, well,
yeah,
we kind of don't have time, but we kind of need to. It's yeah,
yeah. We needed the political flavor that we have currently, like 30 years.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. But not much we can do about that. You can only do with the material conditions as they're provided to you. So,
yeah. All right. So our next book is something related called Revolutionary Suicide by Huey P. Newton. This is a autobiography. Hopefully I said that. I forgot which. Whatever. That a biography. Mm-hmm. Also lays out his political and revolutionary
philosophy.
Yeah. So that should be interesting coming off of this book. To have more of a what does revolution look like from his point of view, and we'll also announce our books for next year. Don't worry, we won't start off with Hegel. It was about Hegel, but yeah. So
we could read The Spirit of Phenomenology, or The Phenomenology of Spirit. Just go back to the source in its original German.
Okay. My Duolingo for German is gonna come in real handy for this.
Yeah. And before we sign off, I'll say I'm thinking, should we start a new ending phrase? So, like, we start with books are good, actually. Should we end with, and remember, go blow up a pipeline?
That will probably get us super banned. Right, so we need, right. Yeah. So unfortunately, no, we can't do that.
Let's workshop it.
Okay. Yeah, we gotta. Yeah, we'll think of something. Anyway, and remember,
books are
good. Actually.